what I've always loved about Athens is this combination between the new and the old. And whilst I've been here, I've been interviewing some Greek artists, some of which who have made it abroad or are making it abroad, and others who have conquered the Greek market. Now, this artist, Kid Moxie, is extremely special.
And I remember soloing Dave Gahan's voice. That was definitely a very emotional moment to create an alienating soundscape for a city that's so warm and inviting. I just sent him the song and I said, I'm from Greece. I'm a massive fan. He replied within an hour. I was a very small part of movie history that was about to kind of like float around and exist for possibly many years to come.
Now don't go away. More from Kid Moxie.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Coming up, just a few seconds to tell you, please subscribe. It helps me and it allows you to be the ones that hear first when I upload something new on the channel.
It felt like they knew exactly who they were talking to.
So, Kid Moxie, welcome. There you are in Los Angeles.
In outer space, rather.
Yeah, well, Los Angeles. And here I am in the center of Athens in Koukaki. Does it make you feel homesick?
No. For one, I was literally just there for almost 6 months. And also, I never really feel homesick because I'm very much splitting my time between Greece and LA. So by the time that I start feeling homesick, I'm already back to wherever the next, you know. So no, I haven't really been homesick in a while.
I want to start by taking you back to your childhood in Greece and then really find out what sort of music you were brought up around, what sort of music your parents played.
My dad basically was the natural DJ of the household. He would be the one to curate the sounds. And it was pretty much, I remember Beatles being the number one most played thing throughout my childhood. And because he still is such a huge fan, he would also make me and my brother learn what Beatle was singing at each particular moment. And he would test us. He's like, who's singing right now? And so he would like be, well, if it's not, it's nasal one is Ringo, soft one is Paul, you know, rock, the more rock edge is John. And then whoever is not that, that's George. So that's kind of like how he tested us. So Beatles was definitely the number one thing I remember sort of growing up around, and a lot of classical music.
It does sound as if your father did that. Then it sort of installed in you a way of listening to music and identifying certain things. Is that true, or am I just making that up?
It probably is. I mean, I kind of feel like it's inevitable once you make music to not listen to music a little bit differently. Not necessarily, that's not necessarily a good thing, because you become a little more analytical. And you're not just letting it all, you know, wash over you organically, I guess. So yeah, I find myself sometimes nitpicking or trying to understand things rather than just enjoying them. Blessing and a curse, probably.
We're of different generations, but when I was brought up, my parents would install in me the idea that I have to do a job to earn money, and creativity wasn't really an area that was pushed. How was that in your family? Did they respect creativity as a possible career?
I didn't really give them a choice, to be honest with you. Like, it wasn't really like, will I become a lawyer or will I be in the arts? It was more like, this is where it's going. Are you on board? Are you going to be supportive? And they actually were very supportive, although I know that it wasn't their first choice. They felt it was a very unsafe thing to be pursuing. But at the same time, they weren't too resistant to it, and they definitely nurtured it and definitely were still have been by my side, whatever choice I make.
Did you perform as a child anywhere? And what did that give you?
I was a little bit of a child actor, actually. I was doing theater and television when I was really little in Greece. And also I was learning to play the piano starting at age 3. And then I would do little concerts. And then throughout elementary school, I became obsessed with Michael Jackson. And who the first album I actually got to know him from was Bad, the album Bad. And so I would dress like him. I would even have a poster over my bed, and I would pray to that poster for things that I wanted in my life. I was like, dear Michael, could you please, me and my family need this, or I would like this in my life. It would always be to Michael. So I started performing as Michael Jackson and inviting people over, and I would put on my own shows. So yeah, I was performing a little bit as a kid.
How did the reaction from an audience affect you?
I mean, I remember it being like, it was definitely very much feeding me in some way, but it was also causing a lot of anxiety. And it was kind of like a double whammy that was a little bit addicting at the time. So therefore I would do it a lot. And I don't know if people were honest with me about being good or not, because you're not going to be honest with a kid if they suck, you know. So I don't really know. But I just remember feeling a very big sense of accomplishment and joy.
When I was a teenager, and I was 13, and I'm a lot older than you, so this was in 1972, I remember seeing David Bowie on TV, and Bowie was my idol. Oh. But also, I was a gay teenager, so I saw David Bowie, and he provided a world where I felt I could belong. And it, obviously, this is of a different era. And I felt I didn't belong in, as you know, living with my parents, because I was going through that process that a teenager goes through. I just wondered if there was an artist where you were a teenager that represented a world in which you wanted to go. And I think that would have been, probably been a bit, little bit older than when you were into Michael Jackson.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I would say Madonna was definitely somebody that I was like, became obsessed with as more as an early teen because of her sort of outspokenness about sex, and which, you know, was very fresh and new to me at the time. And so that was definitely somebody I was like, wow, that exists out there. You know, there's a world where people are outspoken about this. And, you know, in general, putting sexuality as part of your creativity, I feel like such a powerful statement. And I hadn't really seen anybody else do it, or I'm sure others were doing it. I just don't remember it much. And so for quite a few years, that kind of gave me myself an outspokenness about, well, let's talk about what is your problem? Like, let's talk about this. Let's be more open about this. This is hot. It's hot to talk about it. So I feel like it was definitely influencing me as a teenager to look up to somebody like that.
What was it specifically about her, and not just her outspokenness, but what was it about her as a performer, let's say?
The visuals that were used, I remember, I mean, even the older stuff that was like, because I started digging deep into her after the William Orbit album, which I think is a masterpiece in general, but digging deeper into her past, Erotica and the early 90s for me became like such a reference point in terms of aesthetic, in terms of aesthetics and mood. I still, to this day, I was talking to a friend the other day, and we're talking about Madonna, who I haven't been following for a while, but her early 90s years, I feel are like a bombshell of culture within itself. I mean, I could never get over Justify My Love and Erotica and The Sex Book and that kind of aesthetic that she brought. Hand in hand, I guess, with the whole like supermodel culture at the time, it just felt like such a powerful era in music and fashion and aesthetics. And she's so closely interweaved with all that. So that particular, maybe 89, probably to 90, 92, 93 Madonna era, I'm like, that's gold.
Did that actually then influence you to become, and I mean this in the most positive sense, because I've interviewed Madonna and I know how she reacts.
I know, you've interviewed every legend there is.
And you're going to be the next legend, I can tell. And Madonna is like a sponge. She wants to know every bit of information. You mentioned William Orbit. She asked me in 92, mm-hmm. I think it was 92, who she should work with. And I said, William Orbit. He just had an album out. Now, I'm not taking credit because a million people probably said the same thing. But what I found fascinating about her, and I feel that you have the same, because you have so many diverse interests, that you seem to be someone who is able to take information from everyone and bring it into your sphere and use it. Do you believe that's true, how you work?
Yeah, I do. It almost sounds vampiric, the way, because I always thought of Madonna as a vampire in many senses. The fact that she's ever present, the fact that she has managed to, like you said, get the best out of the artists of her era. Every decade, she will recruit the best to get the best out of them in a very, and I mean this in a good way, vampiric way. Do I do something similar? I don't have the same amount of power at this point to recruit exactly the people that, I mean, I would like she did, but I definitely have that same urge that I'm very much of a solo as far as creating, but I really believe in the power of having a collective of artists, and each contributes their best into almost like a Warhol's factory. You know, like, I'm a big fan of Warhol and the factory and that whole notion. So that's always been a fantasy, to have like a creative hub where you bring the best to create. And again, he was a major vampire too. So it comes with, you know, it's a little bit twofold when you talk about getting the best of people, because most of these people actually, I don't feel, got the credit they deserved anyways. So, but I definitely like to absorb what's happening, and there's definitely very concrete and things that I know I like and that I know that I pull from aesthetically and musically.
When did it go from being a childhood actor to someone who makes their own music and composes and becomes a singer as well? When did that actively change?
Well, when I came to the States to study, and I was acting at the time, I realized very quickly, because I think LA will do that to you, you realize that you have very little power, you know, when you're an actor. And at the time, I just felt like I needed more power, as far as creating my own narrative, because being an actor is like, you are being maybe given the chance to audition, maybe given the chance to get the job, to say somebody else's words the way somebody else wants you to, being dressed by somebody else. Like, I was like, no, I want to create my own script, dress myself, create my own parts. So slowly, not too slowly, I guess, within a few, 2 or 3 years, I mean, I was in bands, my own bands. I was also playing for other people like Michael Bublé. I was playing bass for him for a while. So I was being more and more part of the band music community here. And I started a band. I was like, this feels way more fun and way more empowering and way more in tune with who I feel like I am in my core, which is to kind of control my destiny a little bit more. And that's kind of where it changed and Kid Moxie started. It started as a band and very quickly became a solo act because I realized it's very hard for me to be in a band and have to filter creative ideas through other people.
I read an interview where you mentioned Cliff Martinez, who obviously had been a drummer in the Red Hot Chili Peppers and lots of other bands at the beginning. And of course, he created the music for Nicholas Winding Refn's Drive. I presume then you were in Los Angeles by that stage when that film came out. Can you remember when you went to see it and what impact that had on you?
It really changed everything as far as how I thought of music for film and thinking that maybe that's what I want to be doing, because by that point, I was only really thinking of scores as, you know, strings and instrumentals and more of an epic background or background music. And Drive was very much in my wheelhouse in terms of the sonic soundscape that it was creating. And the songs that were in there were just, to this day, I feel iconic. And speaking of, you know, I was working with Italians Do It Better just this last year, who are part of the soundtrack for Drive. So kind of full circle within that decade of me being here and thinking these are exactly the kind of people, sounds, projects that I would love to be a part of, and trying somehow to weasel my way into that universe.
I mean, what's, I think, so amazing about that soundtrack is it's a soundtrack that provides another level in the film. Do you know what I mean? Like, you have the level of the direction, and then you have the level of the script, and you have the level of the acting. But this is another equal component and incredibly important. Was that the moment that you realized that this is fundamentally something, you said it's something that you instantly recognize as what you wanted to do, but did you realize the power of it from that?
It wasn't necessarily that I realized this is what I want to do. I just kind of, it opened a new dimension into how film scoring was perceived by me. And therefore, very soon after, I was like, well, why don't I start creating stuff that perhaps could be in films like that? And then within that year, I started licensing some of my existing music, or making, you know, tracks for a couple of TV shows at the time. Like The L Word was the first one that I remember putting my music to. That was the same year. So yeah, it kind of started this process of, oh, wouldn't that be a cool world to be a part of, perhaps by creating original music for media, film and TV, you know?
How did your agent react? Because I don't know if you've had the same agent the whole time, and that you've sort of moved from one career to another. But did you, by the way, you've just sort of reacted, you got an agent when you started creating music and that music got into films. Was that how it worked?
I didn't have an agent at the time for music. It was just with acting, and which is also how I got my green card to stay in the States and pursue everything, was through acting at the time. And it took me a while to actually get an agent for music. And it's only been the last 3 years, actually, that I've had a really, really good agent that deals with film and television stuff. And that's because of another friend, actually, who is a really, you would know him, another fellow Brit that's a massively well-known composer, Clint Mansell. So he's a really good friend, and he happens to be the person that opened a lot of doors for me in this industry of the composition. So it kind of happened, it was being weaved between me writing new things, knocking on doors, somebody like Clint looking at what I did, liking it, said, hey, let me introduce you to so-and-so, and a record label, Lakeshore Records, who was behind Drive and Stranger Things, who put out my first indie film. So it just kind of like started being weaved slowly, but well, not surely, just slowly. Because
So
nothing is certain in this industry. So yeah.
How did Angelo Badalamenti come onto the scene and that connection happen?
So that's talking about blindly knocking on a door. I was a massive David Lynch, Angelo Badalamenti fan. Mulholland Drive to this day is my favorite film of all times. And it really, talking about changing perspective, like that didn't just shape my aesthetic in terms of music and aesthetics, but also how I see Los Angeles, how you perceive life, connections. Huge game changer that will never cease to be sort of like a focal point of who I am as an artist and probably as a person too. So after I had watched all these films, I became through a friend part of the David Lynch Foundation here in LA, which is pretty much a hub where artists create for philanthropic sort of causes. So I was on this compilation. There was a lot of big artists and lesser known artists. I was part of this compilation of songs that the David Lynch Foundation was putting on. And I remember talking to the director at the time of the project. And I said, hey, could I reach out to Angelo Badalamenti? Do you have a contact? He happened to give me his email. And I emailed Angelo a song I was writing at the time for my first real album, actually. That was 7 years ago. And I just sent him the song and I said, I'm from Greece. I'm a massive fan. I can't convey to you how much what you have created within the David Lynch universe has meant to me over the years. And I just felt like I wanted to share this with you. That was kind of like what I said. And he replied within an hour, which I was really surprised that he even responded. And he had some beautiful things to say about what I had sent him. And then I thought that was it. And then he emailed me a couple of days later and he said, are you going to be in New York by any chance next week? Because I'm thinking about something that we might be able to do together. And obviously I wasn't planning to, but I was like, yes, I am definitely going to be in New York next week. And that's how I met him. And we took a beautiful drive in his vintage white Mercedes in Central Park one night, and we talked about Mysteries of Love and how that song came to be and how that was the first one he wrote for and with David Lynch. And it was the 25 year anniversary of Blue Velvet, and he basically said, do you think you want to redo this with me? And that's what happened. And the whole song was re-recorded with an orchestra. And when I went back to LA, I did the vocals for it. And he was very gracious to let me use it on my first album. And that got a lot of traction. The fact that, that helped me a lot.
Yeah, that track really sounded much fuller. So now you said there was with an orchestra, that feeling that you gave it, but it still had the Julie Cruz beauty in it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Although it's not her, it's you. But it still had that in it, which was really a great idea not to take it so away from the original. Did you feel any fear of doing that?
Of course. Of course. I was mortified, equal parts mortified and motivated would be how I felt. I was like, I tend to be pretty OCD when it comes to perfecting something. So I remember actually counting 88 takes of this track. And I remember nitpicking to death. But when I actually ended up sending it back to him for his feedback, I was nervous, but I also felt like I had done the best that I knew I could. Like I couldn't do this any better than what I did. Like if that wasn't going to work out, then it wasn't going to be me.
What about the response from Lynch?
He loved it. He loved it. And he actually, David Lynch Foundation produced a video for it. And Lynch himself presented that video at this really gorgeous event in downtown LA, the music of David Lynch that happened a few years ago. Duran Duran was headlining. So basically all the people that David Lynch had worked with throughout the last, 20 years were there to present their collaborations with him. And I was just a small piece of it, and probably the most recent piece of it. But from Duran Duran to Angelo to Christabel, Moby, Flaming Lips, Licky Lee, Karen O, it was just a crazy thing to be part of. Crazy thing to be part of.
That must have been an amazing experience.
Amazing. I have to say, the highlight for me was meeting Duran Duran. Apart from David and Angelo, hanging out with Simon Lambon and Duran Duran was like, yeah, that was the best.
Brilliant. You mentioned that, you know, you travel between LA and Greece, and there's many things that you've done here and done in LA. And one of them by a director, Yorgos Djoupopoulos, I hope I got that right.
Yeah.
I've been practicing and I'm having Greek really lessons. So I'm getting really there. Good. So this, not to be unpleasant, but we need a serious talk. You not only created music for that, you also acted in it. What was his method of working with you? Because each director works differently.
Yeah, and honestly, I only acted in this one. I think it's the last thing I've acted in, because I really don't like, I don't want to be acting. So I think it's the last thing I did. That was like 3 years ago. Actually 4 years ago now. So he was like, do you want to be the love interest and slash nurse of our main guy? And because I really trusted him, and there was like a mild love sex scene, which I wasn't really keen on, but he was a very good friend. So I kind of trusted that whatever he and I would do on camera would be done in a very cool, aesthetically pleasing way. And it wouldn't look cheap or weird or anything. And I mean, as far as the director, he kind of knew what he wanted, both with music and acting. He was very precise.
Well, tell me what he said in terms of music.
Very about acting. He was very much about being understated. In Greece, there's a tendency in movies to be very melodramatic, almost soap opera-like. And he was extremely obviously aware of that. So the whole direction was, you're basically, sometimes the most important things in life, the most important things are said in a way that's benign. So it was very much about not making big reactions, nothing over the top, no makeup, which was, that was what I had more of an issue with. I'm like, what do you mean no makeup at all? So everything was very understated and everything was very muted in general, as far as the performances.
Even in terms of the music?
Yeah, I feel like the music was probably a little more dramatic than the acting style in this particular case. But even the music, which is sort of like a sci-fi, esoteric sci-fi score. And when you set that up against Athenian buildings and the Athenian backdrop, which now you're very familiar with, it creates a very different dimension for the city, I feel, because this is not how I am, or most of us that are know Athens, visit Athens, think of Athens. We think of it as much more folklore. We think of it as much more, you're going to hear the bouzouki here and there and somebody screaming on the street. It's not going to alienate you. It's a very warm place. So to create an alienating soundscape for a city that's so warm and inviting, and it's kind of like, it's a very famous place. Everybody knows Athens, even if you haven't been to Athens. So I feel it was a very good choice for him to want a score that is going to make us look at Athens in a very different, cold way.
Now, I just want to ask you to subscribe to this channel. It helps me and it allows you to be the ones that hear first when I've uploaded something else on the channel. Now, I will continue my Greek odyssey, as it were, over the next few months. It's been a wonderful experience to be here and to really see what is going on culturally. And I hope to bring you some of that over this period. Anyhow, let's get back to Kid Moxie.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's fascinating that you live in Los Angeles, which is the complete opposite when you describe Athens in how people view it. And then you describe the music that you created for this, which feels so futuristic, which feels more LA. So it's fascinating that you know those two worlds.
Yeah, and there are many similarities between the two, but ultimately they're vastly different because LA has this facade of being, you almost feel like you're on holiday here because of the palm trees and the sunshine, but it's really a cutthroat, business-centered place. It has way more, it has a lot of antitheses built in. I mean, Athens has too. You know, but they're both very famous cities that even if you haven't been to LA or Athens, you will know kind of their essence by even from afar.
You also created music for a video game for Cyberpunk 2077. And a video, well, a film or a series is in a way linear. You know, you watch it from beginning to end. It may be like Memento and be put in together in a different way, but you watch it from beginning and end. But a video game has levels. So how is it to create music for a video game in comparison to for a film? Is there a difference?
You know, because it was my first, Cyberpunk was my first video game, I didn't really tackle it as really something different. I tend to think of everything as a film because that way you put atmosphere and the vibe first. And then you think about the actual medium. So I guess the difference would be that it's a more interactive format. And when you're dealing with something interactive, it's almost like a first person experience because you're in this game. So when this particular song is playing, it's almost like a self-motivation. It's a little more of an active participation when you're doing something for video games rather than when you're doing film. So that was, I guess, the difference. And the other difference was that for Cyberpunk, I didn't get any image or picture for a long time before, like I was writing blindly just with playlist references. So it was a different process, I guess, technically.
I mean, one of the most sort of beautifully modern romantic series in just the last year or so is when I saw it, is on Netflix was, Maestro, which in other countries to Greece was called Maestro in Blue. Mm-hmm. And it was directed by Christophoros Papakaliatis. Mm-hmm. Nearly got that. Yes.
Exactly.
And I read that he had a very different and interesting way of working. So what did he approach you with and what was his sort of brief to you?
First of all, he's one of the most professional, sweet, but at the same time very much knows what he's doing and knows how to get the best out of his team. One of the best directors as far as how he approaches the material and how dedicated he is to his vision. And he really trusts the people that he invites in his circle. So how I've known Christopher for years, and when he and I were talking about Maestro, it first came with Creep, which was I did a cover for the song, the Radiohead song Creep, which was going to be sort of like a love theme and was going to be used in the trailers for the show. And he basically had already heard another cover I had done for Big in Japan, which also it was for the previous soundtrack we were talking about, for the Unpleasant soundtrack. And he really liked that one. So he basically was like, look, I just already know that I love how you do this. So I trust you. And he wanted it to be ethereal and dark and modern sounding, whatever, you know, exactly that means, like, because the original is so much of that era. It really belongs in, what year was that even? 93, 90, like some, like early 90s, mid 90s, something like that. And so he approached me with that. And then we ended up working on more stuff together for the show as far as the songs go. But Creep was definitely the one that people know the most, I feel. Like that's the one that stood out the most.
I mean, you've talked about him as a romantic and that that he brings, he creates an American style, but he has this sort of Mediterranean romance in it. What is LA romance?
Is there such thing? I mean, to be honest with you, I feel like LA, nobody really comes to LA to fall in love. Everybody that I know for the most part comes to LA because they want to pursue their dreams. And because this is kind of the place that inspires you to feel like you're going to be what you thought you might be able to be. So you're kind of pursuing this fantasy of yourself. It's a very, and when I say narcissistic, it sounds bad. And it is, because that's a big part of what LA is. But it's a very self-fulfilling sort of place that people come to. They don't come here because they want to have a family or settle down or, you know, but obviously there's a lot of dating, a lot of hooking up. Like that's kind of more of LA. It's not so much that you come here to pursue romance. It's not Paris. Not Paris.
Is it a lonely place?
I think it can be. I mean, I've experienced it all. I mean, it's been quite a few years now that I've been here. So I've experienced that too, but I wouldn't personally, I didn't experience it as loneliness, but more like lonesomeness, because lonesomeness to me doesn't carry the negative connotation of being lonely. It can be isolating, which I feel is not a bad thing to be isolated, actually. Like, I don't perceive it as a bad thing to be removed sort of from people for a while, if that's by choice. So yeah, it can be isolating because it's a very goal-oriented, it's me against the world type of place, yeah.
I mean, being on your own can be a very creative space.
The most, in my experience. Actually, that's the most creative, when you are completely on your own. Yeah.
Now, I want to talk about Better Than Electric, because it's an album and a track, but it's sort of a surreal, beautiful song, and you work with Maps. So I want to know how that relationship worked, and about the making of the album, and particularly about one track that was a surprising track in my head for you to cover, but a brilliant version, and you made it so different, the AC/DC Thunderstruck.
Right. Yeah. Well, Better Than Electric with Maps was one of the most beautiful and effortless collaborations I've ever had with another artist. James started this off by providing all of the guitars and rhythmic elements, and I could just feel at the time that this was more of a transcending song, and to me, synths provide a very transcending quality in terms of sound. So I was like, why don't you send me this and I will add synths and melodies on top of it. So it was very much a marriage of our styles in this one song, and it's one of my favorite tracks I've ever actually done, which happened to be also in Maestro, by the way, in a very pivotal scene. Yeah. So that was part of ended up being part of the soundtrack. Because Christopher loved and was like, can I basically have that for a love theme for the teacher and the younger student? So that was Better Than Electric. And Thunderstruck, I can't remember how exactly I landed on that. If it was something somebody suggested, oh, would that be dope? But I'm very much drawn to doing covers of songs that I am the extreme opposite as far as a vocal quality or as far as a style, because I feel like that's going to create the most impact. If I were to cover, for example, Goldfrapp, that would not really be a cover even. It would just, because it's too much of a similar quality. It's ethereal, electronic, female, you know, covering another one. So covering AC/DC or covering Radiohead, I feel like that is a leap. And I think that a cover should be doing a leap into another territory.
Absolutely. And I feel when I heard that, and I do feel this with all your music, that in some way you create, it's like you've created a visual world in your head and then the music to that visual world.
Yeah, absolutely. I always say that it's scenes in my head that just get to be interpreted with music, but it always, that's why I like to call it cinematic pop, is because everything is sort of a scene that applies to, and usually it's scenes that nobody has filmed, they're just playing in my head.
A wild thing that came in for you, which is so interesting, was to do this MGM theme and work on that collaboration. I know that you were on CNN, or you were mentioned on CNN as sort of a person likely to be at the Oscars in the future. Was that in some way connected, that, or did this come through another source? How did that come about?
I still don't know. And I never really asked them when the job came through and they were like, we would like you to do the new Orion logo for MGM. It happened to be around the same time that article that you're mentioning on CNN came out. So part of me thought that, but I also didn't want to ask, because to be honest with you, I was like, I don't want to appear insecure about why are you hiring me? You know, so I was like, I wanted to appear more, of course you are hiring me. Whereas within me, I was like, why again? Like, I've never done something like that. I since then have never done another studio logo. And it's not a very common thing to do. They're very, very few in general. So it's still a puzzle that hasn't been completed in my head as far as why or how it came to be. But what I did realize is that they definitely knew the kind of music and my style, because their references were very much in keeping with what I was already creating. So it was very targeted, is what I guess I'm trying to say.
You did multiple versions, didn't you?
Multiple. There was about 7 or 8 original ideas after that brief that I'll tell you what the starting brief was. And then after that, once we landed on the main idea, then there was about 115 or 120 iterations of that idea. It took almost over a year for those 15 seconds. And the brief was very much what we were talking before. It was like, we want something that sounds like Stranger Things, Neon Demon, Drive, you know, that kind of sonic quality. And I was like, okay, well, I get then that's the kind of stuff I like to do. So it felt like they knew exactly who they were talking to.
I write screenplays and I pitch often to people in Los Angeles, to executives in LA. And it sometimes feels like that old cliche that no one wants to make a decision. In this case, because you've made so many versions, how was the decision made? Was it in the end an easy process, or were they always looking for something to hit them in the face to say, this is the one we want?
Well, I feel once everybody agreed, and when I say everybody, there was a lot of chefs in the kitchen, because it was also happening at the time where Amazon was buying MGM. So it was like, there was Orion, MGM, and now Amazon deciding. So there were so many executives and, you know, people that I never even met or know exactly that were deciding on the fate of this particular project. And for a long time, I actually thought it was not really going to end up happening because of all the mergers happening and people changing and some people leaving and new people coming into the studios. So it ended up being that once we landed on the main idea, then all the nuanced, in the best way, changes that needed to be made took the longest time, because also the logo was also forming at the same time as the music. So those two were growing together at the same time. But ultimately, I don't know who made the final idea, but it seemed like everybody came to an agreement that this was sort of something that was bold enough, yet not alienating, because I think they didn't want to alienate their original what they would call fanboys of Orion from the 90s and early 2000s. So it kind of felt like everybody in the end agreed, which was, you know, I didn't expect it to happen, actually. I thought it was going to fall apart at some point, you know, or another. It wasn't hard. It was because the communication was really good and everybody was very respectful and trusting of each other's work. It just took a really long time and a lot of changing.
How did you feel when you first saw it on a big screen and you heard your music?
That was when we were mixing it with the studio. That was emotional because I remember looking with the lady in charge of MGM creative, I guess, marketing. And she and I said to each other, this is a little piece of film history now that is going to, because usually logos live for many decades and they go and they create a certain nostalgia in us. Like, I feel like most of us, when we hear, you know, the Universal or the old Orion or DreamWorks or whatever it was, there's this kind of like anticipation and nostalgia of the movie. Like, it creates such a fuzzy feeling that the show is about to start. It's kind of like a magical introduction to that the movie magic is about to begin. So it kind of felt like I was a very small part of movie history that was about to kind of like float around and exist for possibly many years to come.
One of the greatest film composers of all time was also Greek, Vangelis, who I think he lived in Plaka at the time. I've got to remember it. But he invited me round and he played privately for me. And wow. It was the most amazing experience I ever had. But you obviously know his work. And I just wondered what you've gleaned from him and the music that he made and whether there is something within that that you have understood about what works.
I've always kind of talked about Blade Runner as a Bible for me over everything, really, in terms of music going hand in hand with aesthetics. One thing Vangelis is up there for me with Angelo Badalamenti and Cliff Martinez, Clint Mansell, Zbigniew Preisner. Like, those are probably some of my favorite composers of all time. But with Vangelis in particular, more than anybody, I feel he managed to create warmth and feeling out of synthesized sounds. And especially in Blade Runner, that to me was just something so magical that I hadn't really... I don't think I've witnessed to that level since then. So that's why, for me, that's the Bible of how, with synthesizers and electronic music, you can create so much feeling. Because I think that feeling hooks in sound in scoring have been overlooked, and soundtracks have just been there to serve an image, which they also should be doing that. But I feel like he was creating a parallel world. And they were both feeding off of each other together with the visuals. So for me, that he's probably the number one for that of his kind.
Isn't there a certain identification factor with Vangelis that you almost from the first note, you know it's Vangelis? That's the other thing that he's managed to do.
Yes.
I do feel that the atmosphere that you create is also incredibly identifiable.
Thank you. That's very important, actually. That's very important to me, to have an identity and to feel like I'm creating. Because I don't want to be the kind of composer that says I can do anything. I can't, and nor do I want to. And I always, you know, tell people, don't hire me for your sports comedy. There's going to be, you know, somebody way better out there to do this. And I like creating my own box and put myself, like, my self-inflicted sort of pigeonholing myself and saying that, yes, I love the world of synthesizers, neon noir. That's how I like to call it, at least. And that's kind of where I thrive. And I think it's important to have an identity that sets you apart, because also from a competitive marketing level, then people will know that this is who they come to when they want to sound like that. Whereas if you do everything, they're like, he or she does everything. So where can, but if you want that, then there is some people that do are known for that. So I want to be, that's what I'm aspiring to be.
So this is this cinematic pop. This is like identification figure. And it's also something, the way you mention it there, it just came into my head, is this is a real route. And I don't mean that you're doing this purposely, but it's a route to have longevity, because if you are identifiable, you can have a very long career.
I mean, yeah, I haven't thought about it that way, but I love to hear that. And I think that could be accurate. Yeah, for sure.
Another Greek director that you worked with is Vasilis Kekatou, who's another is another one of these like rising massive Greek directors in the world. What was it like working with him, and what was his brief to you?
So Milky Way was a series that I recently worked on the score, it was a long process. So it started about 3 years ago with reading the script and sort of discussing the atmosphere at the time. But it's always different when you actually get the footage. So that tend to shift quite a little bit from beginning to how I ended up being in the actual editing room, because there was one way we were thinking about it on paper. And then, I mean, it was still adjacent to the original idea, but it definitely had way more inflections and way more sort of different tones to see it live in front of you. So it was a project that it took a while, and it shifted quite a bit in terms of the tone and the music. And this is one of the youngest directors. This was his first long format. So I had worked with him before on shorter format stuff like editorials for Vogue and commercials and all that. But working on a long format is definitely a very much of a different beast in terms of, and especially for a TV show, because there's just so much that's necessary to do for a TV show. So there was just probably the most amount of, oddly enough, it's still not as long as it took for to create 15 seconds for MGM.
So that really gives it a perspective. Yeah. Now, somewhere along the way, this amazing thing happens. You get an email from Depeche Mode.
Right. So that was 6 months ago or so. We're going kind of chronologically. That was one of the most recent things. Yeah. So last summer, I got an email that seemed to be a prank in my head, because even I think a month before that, somebody was asking me on an interview, what would be like your dream collaboration? I'm a massive Depeche Mode fan since I can remember myself. And I had even in my last album, Better Than Electric, there were a couple of songs that I was imagining Dave Gahan singing instead of me. I was thinking, like, there's a song called Shine that is very much based on Never Let Me Down Again. And it is about two girls taking a ride, two best friends that end up together in the backseat, actually having sex. So it was a twist on Never Let Me Down. So Depeche Mode was always sort of in the back of my head. I was like, oh man, we should give this to Dave Gahan, but how would that ever work out? And I happen to have a manager that's, that is pretty close to them as well. But it didn't actually happen through that. It was just somebody, and I'm not sure who it was, maybe Martin Gore, heard Creep and heard Better Than Electric, the two songs we mentioned before. So in the email, they basically mentioned team of their management mentioned that Depeche Mode heard Creep and they heard Better Than Electric and they loved it. And they were wondering if I could create something similar for as part of their new album. And in terms of a remix / duet, because Dave really likes my voice. So I was like, this was one of those things that you get and you're like, I forwarded to my manager, and he's like, no, this is for real. You know, this is really, I know all of these people in this email, like, this is a real thing. Go for it. You know, let's do it. So it basically, it had a similar effect to when Angelo a few years back had trusted me with something. Although at this point I felt more secure in myself that I, you know, I had already kind of, not to say proved myself, but I have already done some stuff that they had listened to and based off of, they were like, we want that. So I kind of had a compass. And I was surprised though with the amount of freedom that I got and the lack of corrections and notes. And there was one transcending moment where I basically got all the multi-tracks, all the stems to Wagging Tongue, which was the song that we ended up working on. And I remember soloing Dave Gahan's voice in my earphones. And that was, yeah, that was definitely a very emotional moment. You know, the fact that I got to have a solo track from them, and I was trying to figure out, how am I going to pair my vocals with these vocals that I've recognized since I was a kid that mean so much to me? How am I going to weasel myself again into this? Like, how does one do that? But somehow ended up happening because it had to, and because I would never not allow it not to happen. And I send them something that they loved upon first listen, and they just basically took as it was. There was no like, 2:33, can you change this? Can you raise Dave vocals? Can you take out the sax? You know, so, and I also felt like I wanted to be a little risky. I don't usually use saxophone, and I feel like saxophone can be such a tricky thing. It can borderline cheesy very easily. But then I was kind of like, the references in my head when working on Wagging Tongue for them were Blade Runner, one, as far as the sonic soundscape, and Roxy Music, because of the sax and just because of that. I'm a huge fan of Roxy Music and the atmosphere they create. So I was like, I want to make something bold. I don't want to just put a fucking beat, you know, and put our voices on top. That's just such a cop out. And I want this to be, even if this doesn't make the record, and even if they never put it out, like, I want to be listening to this and feel like this is the best I could have done. And this is something unique and something that shows to them that I really took time and I really freaking cared, because I really did, more than most things I've ever done. I really cared about that one.
And their reaction was, this is great. The first time, no changes.
There was nothing. Yeah, there was like no changes. And to the point that I thought, okay, maybe they actually are not going to put it out. They just thought it's cool, because obviously if they are going to put it out, they're going to have some changes. They cannot. But they just put it out as it was.
That's amazing. But you've never met them, have you?
No, never. It was just through, everything was emails. Because they were on tour. They still are on tour, on the Memento Mori tour. So I never, they were already in Europe by the time that this started.
Although you've never met them, what do you feel that, you know, when we meet people, we always sort of glean something from them and we always learn something from them. What do you think people learn from you? What did Angelo Badalamenti learn from you? What did all these great people you've worked with? But I'm sure they, you know, like, you always, one always contributes to a meeting of minds. And so I just wondered what you feel that you offer other people, what they go away with and what they're enriched with by meeting you.
You know, I never actually thought about it, but speaking of Angelo, I don't know, maybe he felt, I think maybe I come across as somebody that dreams big and somebody that is, I'd like to think a pure quality about the way I dream, that anything can be possible, and that when things are happening in real time, I actually try to be in this moment with whoever it is, and that some things are transcending. Some things are not just, oh, I just got to meet so-and-so. You know, some things are more than just moments. And I feel like, for example, with Angelo, I felt he felt this kind of the pure dream quality of somebody that comes from very far away and is kind of like just starting out pursuing what they love the most. And at the same time, a lot of people have said that my tone, my music is sort of ethereal. So I feel like maybe that's something that artists like that tend to appreciate. And the other thing that I always say is I feel like people at that level trust their intuition a lot more. Like when you're of that caliber, you don't really second guess a choice to go with somebody that perhaps is new because you've seen one or two things that really just work for you. And that's also who I aspire to be as I'm keep growing into what I'm doing, is to really trust my intuition and that first feeling that this just might be something magical. And don't try to think about it too much, because if some of these people try to think about it too much, I would have not been given the choice. I mean, the chance, not the choice. Yeah.
You mentioned that arc in your life, the arc, you know, the time that you saw Drive, and you mentioned Italians Do It Better, and that how that arc has been sort of fulfilled lately. So tell me about working with Nina the EP Lust that you've made together.
Yeah, that was honestly one of the most, in my head, one of the most beautiful and cohesive in terms of music and sound, music and visuals, collaborations I've ever done. And also the fact that it was hosted by Italians Do It Better. Now, Johnny Jewel, who is, you know, we all know who Johnny is, especially if you're into electronic music and soundtracks and the Chromatics, and you're of that persuasion. He's very much somebody that is very involved in the merge of visuals and music. And that kind of bled through into the project, because visuals and music were very closely intertwined. And this project started with an idea I had about covering J-Lo's Waiting for Tonight and making it into sort of like a synth noir Miami 1984 sort of lustful song between two women. And then I was like, that turned out really well. And I was like, well, I said to Nina, why don't we do more like that, but original stuff? And that's kind of how the Lust project started. We ended up, I started writing the music in Greece at the time, because it was during COVID and I was there for a while with my co-producer. And then Nina and then I traveled to Germany, and she and I went into studio, wrote all the lyrics. And then she came here to LA and we did all the visuals. So it was kind of like Athens, Berlin, LA. It was like a triangle where music, lyrics, and visuals kind of were all completed into what the project Lust came to be. And I'm extremely proud and of this particular project. And it's our sophomore release with Italians, and it's a label that I know I've always kind of wanted to be a part of, because it feels like the coolest cult in terms of, you know, the music I like. I was always like, I'd love to be with, you know, I'd love to release something with Italians Do It Better. And so, yeah, from 10 years ago, listening to Drive and, you know, all their songs and their contributions to the soundtrack that really changed everything for me, full circle to actually working with them and being part of their collective, really cool aha moment.
What I found most interesting about artists is that a lot of them, their drive comes from a childhood wound. Something in their past has sort of pushed them to create and often compensate for something that happened in their childhood.
I don't know if it's a good thing, but I do feel like for some reason I need to keep proving myself. And, you know, I'm not sure where that stems from. I don't have a concrete event in my life that I can recall, to be honest with you, from early childhood. But it's almost like there's definitely a drive that comes from something that's not as aspirational. And that is kind of like a darker sort of side that wants to just prove that I can, you know. But I'm not sure who instilled this or how that was instilled in me. But I know that there's a vanity. There's a great vanity that is attached to dreams. And I feel like that must become, and I live in a city of vanity, you know, like you kind of become competitive with yourself and what you envision yourself that you could be, and you're always comparing yourself to the version of yourself that you thought you were going to be by this stage of your life, by this stage of your life. So I always feel like I have something to prove. And that's definitely a driving force.
Well, that's brilliant. It's been brilliant to talk to you. And I want to thank you.
Thank you so much, Steve.
I want to thank you because I think it's really important to thank artists for their what they've added to the creative universe. And I really loved going through all your music and listening to it and doing the research for this. And it's been brilliant to meet you. And I'm looking
for legend. You're a freaking legend.
Oh.
No, really, seriously, you really are. And thank you for taking the time and for digging, you know, really deep actually into what I do and who I am. And I really, really appreciate it.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I hope to see you again. So I'm going to say goodbye. When I switch off, you will magically disappear. But Kid Moxie, you will never disappear. You will be in our lives forever. Okay. Bye.
Thank you, Steve. Take care.
Up there is an interview I recommend. Down there is where you can find all the podcast interviews. And here is where you can connect.